We're going to do something different today. We're going to do a summary that hopefully will help us see what we've covered so far. And then from here on out, we're only going to attack Revelation once a month. And once a month, we will do a lesson on Revelation. And we'll get through it when we get through it. Hopefully, this will give everybody opportunity to be able to grasp what we're going to study. I mean, when we get to chapter 10, chapter 10 is what I was going to prepare this week, but chapter 10 is a history lesson of what we were just talking about, 1844 movement that arose out of the prophecies of the trumpets. As a result of the prophecies of the trumpets, 1844 came about. We can't miss that. Then we'll do chapter 11, which will be the French Revolution. Then from there on, you know, you move ever closer into prophecies that have not been fulfilled. So chapter 13 has not been fulfilled, but we can definitely figure out what's going on in there because we have the prophecy of Daniel. Chapter 14, the first five verses have not been fulfilled. That's talking about the 144,000 on the sea of glass. That has not been fulfilled. We're not there yet. But verse 6 through 12 has been. That's the three angels' messages. Verse 13 of chapter 14 to the whole rest of the book is all future. We can only talk about it as understanding types and symbols and putting that with previous history. Other than that, we can't say much about it. We can't go to history and say, look here, this was absolutely fulfilled, because it has not been. We step from the realm of history into the realm not of speculation, but into the realm of understanding as things unfold around us. As events happen, we understand the history. As events happen, we can say, yes, I know this is happening. This is fulfilling this prophecy. And that's why Jesus said he gave us the prophecy. It was so that when it happens, we would have faith in him. The first slide here, I ask this question every week. Jesus is coming soon. Are you ready? Because I've used this every week, nobody's paid any attention to it, I'm sure. Are we ready? What does it take to be ready?
You have to be converted.
You got to be converted. You got to die to self, like we said that song should be singing about. And it's only as we die to self and we surrender to Christ, we're ready.
Yes.
And at that point, we are perfect. Just like a little seed goes in the ground, it's a perfect little seed. Tomorrow, it's a perfect little sprout. The next day, it's a perfect little, you know, whatever. It's a perfect little whatever until it grows to full maturity. So can we be perfect in our Christian walk? Yes. Every day we can be perfect in our Christian walk because we are surrendered to Christ. That's all he asks. This was a chart I handed out. So what I'm going to do, these are just slides that I had from the previous lessons, and we're just going to go through them and summarize very briefly what we've covered about Revelation. Revelation chapter 1, we discovered, was the title is wrong because it says the revelation of John the Divine. No, it's the revelation of Jesus Christ. And in chapter 1, Revelation shows us a picture of Jesus walking among the candlesticks. The candlesticks represent the seven churches. In chapter 2 and 3, the outline of the seven churches is given to us with their history, with their commendation, reproof, exhortation, and promises. Each section of the scripture here in Revelation has seven. We have seven churches, seven seals, seven trumpets, seven thunders, seven plagues at the end. The number seven, we discovered, it means total. It means fullness. It means perfection. So the seven churches, the seven seals, and the seven trumpets give us a complete history of the church from the time of Christ until the second coming. We cannot understand the future without looking back to the past. And the distinction here is the Jewish mindset, the Hebrew mindset, I should say, to the Greek mindset. The Greek mindset always looks forward and never wants to look back. The Hebrew mindset always looks back. They understand that if they know how God has led them in the past, they can figure out where they're going. And the illustration of that was like a person in a rowboat. You don't set your navigation based on where you're headed. You're rowing this direction, and the only way to get to where you want to go is to keep your sights on something on the other side of the lake. Then you know where you're going, and you're going to end up in the right place. The first 11 chapters of Revelation have all taken place. They've all been filled in time, in real history. They have no future application. The majority of the churches in the world today claim that they have future application. As far as they're concerned, they have never been fulfilled in history. And that's the distinction between what we believe the Protestant Reformation taught and the futurist position that most churches in the world teach. They take Revelation chapter 4 all the way to the end of Revelation and say it's all going to be fulfilled in the future when this Antichrist comes into view. We learned the Protestant view said, which is the same as the historicist position, because history is the historicist position, Ephesus was the apostolic age. It took place during the time of the apostles. When John died shortly after AD 100, that was the end of the apostolic age. Smyrna was the next church period to come up, and that was a period of pagan persecution because pagan Rome attacked the Christians. Pergamos, from the time of Constantine's time to the great apostasy in 538, was the time of the Pergamos church, during which time paganism was married back into true Christianity and pagan notions were accepted. Thyatira is the church of papal persecution. The church went from being persecuted, true Christians went from being persecuted by pagan Rome to being persecuted by papal Rome. We studied that. Sardis is the Protestant Reformation period. This was the time, beginning about 1350, when John Wycliffe in England decided to translate the Bible into common English so that everyone could understand it. From that point on, 1350 onward, to the middle 1600s, was a time of Reformation. The men looked at history. They could see from history that the papacy fit the prophecies of like 2 Thessalonians 2 and Revelation and Daniel. They could see that. And it led them into an understanding of Scripture that they'd never had before. And they tried to reform the Catholic Church. They did not try to start the Lutheran Church or the Baptist Church and every other church that's out there. That was not their purpose. The Reformers' purpose was to reform the Mother Church. It didn't work. It was because of their understanding of the prophecies that they were able to do the work that they did during the Protestant Reformation. Luther knew absolutely who the Pope was because he read the prophecies. The Philadelphia church was a church of great revival. Like I said, the Protestant Reformation came to an end. The second generation did not pick up and go forward as they should have when Luther and Zwingli and Calvin all passed off. Then the men that came along behind them settled into creedal understandings just like the Catholic Church had done. They adopted certain man-made creeds and they said, this is what we're going to live on. And they went away from their Bible again. The Philadelphia church was a time of great revival, and this began in the early 1700s. And there were two great revivals during this period that brought us to the 1844 event that we'll get into when we study chapter 10. Then the Laodicean church is the church of the last age and precedes the second coming of Christ. That's the church that we're living under now. That's the church period that we're living under. Now, these two periods of the church, Pergamos and Thyatira, are the two that had the most effect on the church at large, because, like I said, under these two churches, this apostasy came in. Under this church, paganism was baptized as Christianity, and Constantine signed the first national Sunday law in AD 321. Sunday and Sabbath were in competition up to this time. By AD 321, when the law was passed, then it became the legal edict of the land to worship on the venerable day of the sun. Venerable means honorable or holy or whatever. So in writing this document, Constantine said, Sunday is, the first day of the week is holy unto the sun. He didn't say it was holy unto Jesus or God. It's the venerable day of the sun, and therefore that's the day that we shall keep as the Christian worship day. The Sunday and Sabbath, Seventh-day Sabbath, were both kept, but not during the lifetime of the apostles. There is no scriptural support for it. There is no apostolic support for it. It is historical. Yes, you can go back and you can read about the origin of Sunday, which goes all the way back to the Tower of Babel. It's been around a long time, and it has always been in competition with the Seventh-day Sabbath. But in the Christian era, it did not come in until in the 200s. And then it came in competition to the Seventh-day Sabbath, because in history, the Jews were still causing trouble. So if you were a Judaizing Christian and you kept the Seventh-day Sabbath, then you were under persecution. If you were a non-Judaizing Christian and you kept the first day holy, you might have kept the seventh day holy, but you didn't let anybody know. The Sunday was the prominent day. They also tagged in that Sunday was a day of fasting and mourning, and who wanted to do that? Sunday was a festival day when you could eat and rejoice and whatever, because we're celebrating the resurrection. So Satan worked very hard to make a contrast between the two days. And he was quite successful at it. So that over the years, gradually, it moved from the Seventh-day Sabbath into the Sunday Sabbath being the day that people wanted to keep. And by the time of Constantine in 321, it was the predominant festival day for Christians, just because it was more convenient. You weren't persecuted if you kept Sunday. You were just like everyone else. It allowed the pagans to be more willing to come join the church with you, so their evangelism was more successful. You know, the pagans didn't have to do a whole lot of change. They didn't have to switch from one day to the next. They didn't have to give up their idols, because they just renamed the idols from Zeus to Peter or whatever, you know, and they kept the church idols just as they were. So, all these compromises came in under the Pergamos church. That's what I'm talking about with baptized paganism coming into the church. The Thyatira church is the church period during which papalism was set in place. Justinian got tired of fighting, Emperor Justinian got tired of fighting in the western half of the empire, and he gave power, beginning in 508, he signed a document that gave power to the bishop at Rome. And he says, from here on out, you fight your own battles. I'm going to worry about Constantinople. And he gave full power to be a corrector of heretics to the Pope and to fight his own battles. He could use whatever army he wanted to. From 508 until 538, the Pope then set about trying to destroy these pagan hordes that were running over Italy and attacking Rome. But the power was given, and eventually the power was completely obtained. And the prophecy, we have 1260-day prophecy that began in 538 and ran to 1798, when, under the French Revolution, the Pope was taken captive and the power of the papacy over government was broken. The Catholic Church still existed, but their power over government was broken. Wounded, that's right. Rick?
In relation to both Thyatira and Pergamos, there have always been not only the Waldenses and other independent groups of Sabbath keepers, but within the Eastern Orthodox Church, there have been pockets of Sabbath keepers.
That's right.
That did not meet on Sunday. Instead, they kept Sabbath.
That's right. And there still are.
Yep.
Yeah, and we studied that when we went to Islam. This is kind of jumping ahead in our history, but Scott asked the question last time about, didn't Islam move into areas where Christianity had been established? Well, yes, it did. We had a map, and we showed how it did go into those areas. But interestingly enough, and I didn't bring this point out, I got distracted last week with my discussion, and I just clicked past that slide. But interestingly enough, the areas that Islam went into where there were Seventh-day Sabbath keepers, they did not bother them. They only converted the pagans. As they moved into the area that we now call Pakistan and on into India and Southeast Asia, there were Christians there, but they were Seventh-day Christians. They weren't Seventh-day Adventists, because the Seventh-day Adventist Church wasn't in existence then, but they were Seventh-day Christians. They kept the seventh day holy. And when Islam showed up in those areas, such as Goa, India, they did not harm those people, because the prophecy, and we'll go on, I have a slide on that, the prophecy said do not harm those that have the seal of God. It said harm only those that don't have the seal of God. I turned it around to a positive statement. But anyway, so during this time, that's getting ahead, during this time period in Thyatira, paganism came to a head in the papal system and challenged Christ's very authority by saying, I am, you know, the Pope says, I am God on earth. I have the power to loose the gates of heaven or hell. And that challenges Christ's authority. The Sardis Church, we've mentioned that, is the Protestant Reformation. The Protestant Reformation began to dwindle after the first, the initial men died, Luther and Zwingli and Calvin and all those guys died, but it really came to an end in 1648 with the signing of the Peace Treaty of Westphalia. There had been a 30 years war among all of Europe, and they finally decided that we've got to bring an end to this war. We're tired of killing one another, and they signed this Peace Treaty of Westphalia. That essentially, by the Protestants signing that document and agreeing to that document, they ceased their war against the Papal Church. The Papal Church had not changed. The Papal Church had not been reformed. But the reformers quit trying to reform. And it took another 100 years almost for anything else to happen. Under the Philadelphia Church, missionary expansion went around the world. Bibles were published. Bible societies were established all around the world. You can see here how rapidly they went into places like Tahiti, South Seas, all through Central America. David Livingstone gave his life in America. I mean, they buried his heart over, I mean, in Africa. They buried his heart over there in Central Africa. They worked very hard to try to bring Christianity to these non-Christian areas. Then the work in America, under the preaching of William Miller and others, he was not the only one, but at this time in America, William Miller was also counterbalanced by preachers in Europe. He was not the only one preaching this. They all studied this out, and that's what we'll get to when we get to chapter 10. There were many people studying around the world, and they all came to the same conclusions on Daniel, that the end time prophecy of Daniel 8:14 was coming to a head. And they understood that because they finally figured out the key through history when they figured out what the trumpets was about. The great disappointment? Yes, there was a great disappointment in 1844. But that follows the prophecy in Revelation 10, because he was to take the little book, he was to eat it up, sweet in the mouth, bitter in the belly, thou must prophesy again. The work was not finished. There was more work to do. During the Philadelphia church, we saw the three great signs that Christ talked about in Matthew 24. The Lisbon earthquake, which was the most devastating earthquake to ever strike the world. The loss of life was phenomenal. November 1st was a Sunday, and when this thing struck, people were in churches in Spain and Portugal. This thing knocked down the churches and killed tens of thousands of people. There were people drowned in this great tsunami that came ashore and washed everything away. This earthquake was felt all the way up into Germany, down into Africa, and over into North America. This was a really, really strong, I mean, it'd probably be like off the scale if we could have put a scale to it. The dark day, followed by the moon of blood, was also prophesied during this time. Christ said it would be, and it was. It was fulfilled to the T. And then we had the falling stars during this Philadelphia period. There are scientists who have tried to say that this dark day was, it really wasn't anything phenomenal. It was just, you know, there was a fire in the Canadian provinces, and this fire was what caused the sun to be darkened, because there was this big cloud that came through that blotted out the sun, and they had this very scientific explanation about why the day was dark and why the moon filtering through this cloud of smoke looked red. Well, so what? Christ predicted it 1,800 years in advance. Does it matter what it was caused by? No. Christ predicted it was going to happen. He predicted the order that it was going to happen. Earthquake, dark day, moon of blood, stars falling. He said it in that order. That is the order that these events took place. It doesn't matter that there's a scientific explanation for it. So scientists can explain away all they want to. It still doesn't detract from the fact that it was a prophecy that came through on time and was fulfilled perfectly in history. Under the seven seals, we find a white horse that we know correlates to the Ephesus church, and we give the dates AD 34 to AD 100. The red horse is the church under persecution. Red symbolizes blood and persecution. White symbolizes purity. The black horse symbolizes corruption and rot, like gangrene setting in. The pale horse, paleness means death is imminent. You know, you put a plant away from light, it turns pale. Patients who are sick with their last gasping breath, they're quite pale. And that's what we find under this pale horse church. Because this was the time of that spiritual nourishment was being kept away during this dark ages. You know, that's why we call it the dark ages. If you don't want to be politically correct, you call it the Middle Ages. But it was the dark ages. Education of all kind was kept away from the people. There was no, I mean, not just no Bible study, there was no education. The fifth seal is the Church of the Reformation, correlates with Sardis, and we gave the date 1350, and that's an approximate date because stuff was rumbling around before this time, and stuff really didn't get going under the Reformation until Luther nailed his 95 theses on the Wittenberg door, and that was 75 years later. But still, 1350 is when John Wycliffe began to preach, so that was really kind of a very starting date for the Reformation, and 1798 is the ending date for this seal. The sixth seal, time of Philadelphia, correlates to the Philadelphia church. We've sort of covered that because we covered the churches, and they go hand in hand. The seventh seal is the cleansing of the sanctuary, and that's the Laodicean church, 1844 to the second coming. Now, in chapter 6, the question was asked, who shall be able to stand? After all these seals and the terrible things that are happening, who can be able to stand when God's day of wrath has come upon the earth? So, we understood this, that chapter 7 was a parenthetical statement that answered this question. And it was about who are the 144,000. Chapter 7 gives the answer to that question. So who are the 144,000? We discovered that they are not literal Jews. There's not going to be 144,000 literal number of Jews who do anything at the end of time. They're not all male. They're not all male virgins, by linking it over there to chapter 14. That's true. They're not all male. They're not all female. They are Israel, but it's spiritual Israel. And as we studied through the names of the tribes, we found that there were some names that were left out. Joseph got a double portion. Joseph is named. Manasseh is named. Ephraim is not, Dan is not, and as we study the characters, names tell us character. My name is Anne. I was misnamed because Anne means grace, and I don't have much. But they had a desire to give me some, and they named me Grace. Names have meaning, especially if you're Jewish. They have meaning, and sometimes they would take 3 years to name a child because they had to know the child's character before they named him. Now Esau and Jacob, they had their character. They were named as soon as they were born. But Jacob's name was changed, wasn't it? To Israel. Because Israel means faith. Israel means one who has power with God. So the concept of Israel is those who have faith in God and have reliance upon God for all things. We are spiritual Israel because we have faith in God. And all of Paul's writings relate to Israel in that context. So the New Testament concept of Israel is a spiritual context, not a literal context. And that's what we learned when we studied this. We also learned that futurism throws this 144,000 off into the future. It's going to be a literal number of Jews who, you know, after the work of the Antichrist is going to stand up and do whatever. But we learned that that concept, the futurism concept that is believed by the majority of the churches in the world today, Christian churches, came about during the Protestant Reformation as part of the Catholic Counter-Reformation. It was a method by which to take the heat off the Pope. Francisco Ribera, decided that if he takes all these prophecies and he throws them off into the future someplace, then they can't point the finger at the Pope for who he is. And they have done exactly that. Who are the 144,000? The Bible gives us the answer. These are they which came out of great tribulation and have washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. And that's us, sitting right here today. That's us. It describes our character of surrender, just like we said in the first slide there, opening up. What does it mean to be ready for Christ? We have surrendered. We have washed our robes in the blood of the Lamb, and we're ready for him, whether he comes today or 10 years from now. We're just as ready today as we will be 10 years from now, because we've surrendered to him every moment of our lives. Then we come to the trumpets. We learned that under the Old Testament trumpets, there were several things that when you study the trumpets in the Old Testament, that they point to. Trumpets were used to symbolize war. When they were about to go to war, they blew the trumpet, you know, and they, you know, you watch all these old Westerns, and they're blowing trumpets, right, or cornets or whatever, to tell the people what to do. They have trumpets for getting out of bed. They have trumpets for, you know, coming to meals. They have trumpets, you know, you have to know the trumpets if you're going to be, they got whistles in the Navy, right? Same thing. But they, you know, you blow the trumpets, and it's different trumpet sounds for, and little tunes, and that tells you whether you have to assemble for, on the you know, whatever, or charge, or, you know, they have, trumpets have these symbols. They still do, even in the army today. They also announce judgment against enemies. And they call God's people to prepare spiritually for its final day of reckoning. We saw that in the Old Testament type, the blowing of the trumpets took place on the new moon of every month, from Pentecost to the Day of Atonement in the fall. Trumpets were only blown in this context, and they warned people, 2 more months, 1 more month, until the Day of Atonement comes. Then on the Day of Atonement, they blew trumpets again. The trumpets were also used to announce the Jubilee coming. We're going to review again the Pergamos church time frame, 313 to 538. We saw this compromise with paganism, a great falling away that Paul predicted in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 1 to 12, when this Gnostic philosophy came in that changed the concept of who God was, changed the concept of the nature of Christ. All these things came in and changed the truth of the Bible into tradition, and they compromised. And they took tradition instead of the Bible. The trumpets warned the church. I mean, that's what God used the trumpets for, was to warn the church to turn around and to come to repentance. Didn't work. During the Thyatira church, the papacy was established. Doctrines were developed that were contrary to Bible truth, and persecution of God's people took place. The vision of the trumpets repeats the time frame of the history of the seven churches and the seven seals, but the prophecy under the trumpets tells of the political history surrounding the church and of pending judgments against the church. The vision of the trumpets uses the biblical principle of repetition and expansion. You find that in the book of Daniel, and you find it here in Revelation. The prophecy is given in a nutshell, then it's given in a little more expanded view with a little more detail, then it's told again in yet a bigger view with a little more detail. And this is the way prophecy unfolds in the Bible. Now, the first trumpet was Alaric and the Goths. He swarmed down into Rome and actually captured Rome in 410. The second trumpet was Genseric and the Vandals. Genseric and the Vandals swarmed up from northern Africa and attacked Rome by sea. Captured Rome in 455. The third trumpet was Attila and the Huns. He rode over the Alps, got all the way down to Rome, but he was working with Genseric. He wasn't actually trying to capture anything, and he never did capture anything, but he worked a counterbalance coming down from the north. The fourth trumpet was Odoacer and the fall of the Western Empire. In 475, the emperor in the western half of Rome was captured, and there never was another emperor in Rome after this time. During this time period, darkness in the religious and political worlds because of the rise of papacy. The fifth trumpet is the rise of Islam and it correlates with the first woe. Islam began to push in 622, and by 732, it had gone all across North Africa, up into Spain and Portugal, and was knocking on the door of France when Charles Martel stopped them at the Pyrenees Mountains. After that, they gradually fell back out of Spain into North Africa and began to push around the other direction. The other direction is the sixth trumpet. They then began to push up into Turkey and trying to come into Europe from the eastern side instead of from the western side. The fifth trumpet is also the second woe, and we set the dates here, 1299, because that was when Othman organized the sultanates, and there were four sultanates that were bound by the river Euphrates, is what the scripture said, and we found that the binding was not that it was like putting them in chains or putting them in prison. The binding was that they were in the borders of, the boundaries of, the area of the Euphrates River, and this was true. There were four sultanates in that area, and Othman unified them, and they became then the Ottoman Empire, and they began to push from the eastern side into Europe, and finally did capture Constantinople and began to swarm into Europe. The prophecy in Daniel 2, and we have to tie the prophecy in Revelation back to the prophecies in Daniel, because one explains the other. The prophecy in Daniel 2 of Nebuchadnezzar's dream, he saw this statue, remember? Head of gold, chest of silver, belly of brass, two legs of iron, not one leg. Everything had been a unified thing. When we get down to the legs, there's two. And then there's 10 toes. The two legs indicate the two halves of the Roman Empire. You had the eastern and the western half. The 10 toes are what became of that Roman Empire when it was split up into the multiple nations in Europe. So the prophecy is accurate. The trumpets beat against the legs and the toes. The prophecy of Daniel's 10 horns was that three horns would be replaced by a little horn which came up among the 10. History proves this prophecy true. Papal Rome rose to power while destroying three tribes that opposed it, three pagan tribes that had been persecuting and giving it a hard time during this couple hundred years' time. Those three tribes that were plucked up were the Vandals, who had swarmed up from northern Africa, the Heruli, and the Ostrogoths, who had come down out of Europe. They were completely destroyed. The other 10 tribes succumbed to papal power, and they converted, whether in true heart conversion or not, but they converted and became then vassals, as it were, of the Pope at Rome, and did his bidding, and warred against whoever he sent them out after. So the papacy then became an empire sort of thing, because he had the armies of these pagan tribes to use as he willed. This little chart shows all the characteristics that describe this little horn power. You probably can't read them very well, but we had a handout on it. Paul, in 2 Thessalonians, said that there would come a great falling away, and we have seen that this was fulfilled in history. Pure Bible truth was laid aside for the doctrines of men. It was taking place in his day. He could see it. But he said there was something hindering. The prophecy there in 2 Thessalonians said there was something that hindered. That's what let meant. That this letteth, and it had to get out of the way before this other thing would come up. Well, that was absolutely true, because pagan Rome had to get out of the way so papal Rome could come up. So that which hindered the rise of the papacy was pagan Rome. Once pagan Rome was subdued, papal Rome came into power. Then we move on into the trumpets. The fifth trumpet is the first woe. The fifth trumpet was allowed to torment, but not to slay. It talked of the fifth trumpet as swarms of locusts coming up. Well, that's exactly what they were. There was this vast number of Muslims who came up out of Arabia, out of the Arabian desert. Let's read the prophecy. It's quite profound. The prophecies here on the fifth and the sixth trumpet are so profound that they are an absolute fulfillment of prophecy to the day. The 150 year was to the year. I mean, these prophecies, if we understand these prophecies as having been fulfilled in time, we have confidence in God. We know that the scripture is correct, and we can trust Him for the future. This prophecy said, Revelation 9, verse 1 to 4, "And there came out of the smoke locusts upon the earth, and unto them was given power as the scorpions of the earth have power. And it was commanded them that they should not hurt the grass of the earth, neither any green thing, neither any tree, but only those men which have not the seal of God on their foreheads." This is what I was talking about earlier when I said that Islam did swarm into these areas, but they left the Seventh-day Sabbath keepers alone. And there are still Seventh-day Sabbath keepers that count their time back to the original Apostle Thomas, who settled in Goa, India. There are Seventh-day Sabbath keepers in Ethiopia who count their history back to those early apostles that came down there with the truth. So there are pockets of Seventh-day keepers around the world that have apostolic origin, and they were not harmed, even to this day, by Islam, because the prophecy said they wouldn't be. We find a striking fulfillment of this prophecy of hurt not the earth or any green thing at the command of Abu Bakr, Muhammad's uncle. Muhammad died in 632, and his uncle took over the work. Abu Bakr said, "When you fight your battles of the Lord, acquit yourselves like men without turning your backs. Let not your victory be stained with the blood of women or children. Destroy no palm trees, nor burn any fields of corn. Cut down no fruit trees, nor do any mischief to cattle, only such as you kill to eat." It's almost like Abu Bakr read what John wrote, because it's almost word for word. The prophecy said, hurt no green thing. Well, palm trees are green trees, right? Fruit trees are green trees. So this absolutely, almost word for word, fulfills the prophecy. This is just incredible. Abu Bakr also said, "As you advance into the enemy's country, you will find a sort of men who belong to the synagogue of Satan and who have shaven crowns. Cleave their skulls. Give them no quarter till they embrace our faith or pay tribute." Now, who is it that shaves their heads? Only the top of their heads.
Monks.
Monks. It's called a tonsure, and it's a sign of humility. So Abu Bakr knew who he was talking about, and that's the target. When you swarm into these areas that are held by the Catholics, only go after the ones that are true Catholics. Don't bother the true Christians. And they, to this day, say, you know, there are people who are students of the book, and they're talking about this book. And the only reason that today there is jihad is because Christians are not following this book. And they see us as apostate, and they see us as their duty to correct us, because we're not following the book. Jesus identified this synagogue of Satan in chapter 2. He said, Jesus said, this church is where Satan's seat is. Seat means throne. It's where Satan dwells. He talked about that in Revelation 2:13. This validates the prophecy of this first woe, because showing that it belongs to the time of the Pergamos and Thyatira churches. The sort of men who belong to the synagogue of Satan. I'm lumping Pergamos and Thyatira together because what began in the Pergamos church came into full power under the Thyatira church. Hurt only those men which have not the seal of God in their foreheads. Now, we've already covered this, so I won't spend a whole lot of time on it. This correlates, the seal of God in their foreheads correlates to chapter 7, where we studied about the 144,000, and it correlates to chapter 14, verse 12, right? Here are they that keep the commandments of God and the faith of Jesus. You have the seal of God in your forehead. Chapter 13 is all about those people who have the seal of God in their forehead, as opposed to those who have the mark of the beast in their forehead or their hand. And we'll get to that when we get to chapter 13. So this sealing of God, this sealing in the forehead of the power of God is all about faith in God's power to deliver from sin. The sixth trumpet was allowed to slay, and that's exactly what they did. They didn't just torment, they tormented for a period of time, but they were allowed to slay. The remaining one-third of the old Roman Empire is now called the Byzantine Empire. The time frame for this work was 5 months, and it began after Othman organized those four sultanates into the Ottoman Empire, and he swarmed against Constantinople. It took him 5 months, which in prophetic time is 150 years. He began his campaign July 27th, 1299. They finally took down Constantinople July 27th, 1449, 150 years later. The prophecy is absolutely accurate to the day. And to take this prophecy, like futurists do, and say it's got a future application destroys the purpose for which God gave this prophecy. The purpose of this prophecy is to show who God is. And futurism destroys that. The next unique prophecy that was given under this time period is here. Saying to the sixth angel, which has the trumpet, loose the four angels which are bound in the great river Euphrates. And the four angels were loosed, that's the four sultanates we talked about, which were prepared for an hour and a day and a month and a year. This is a very exact prophecy. We discovered that it breaks down. An hour is 15 days, because it's prophetic time. A day is 1 year. A month is 30 years. A year is 360 years, and it adds up to 391 years and 15 days. Pretty specific time prophecy. If we start counting from the time that they captured Constantinople, and that's what we have to do because we had the 5 months prophecy that ended in 1449, the next prophecy comes right on its tail, so we have to say the 391 years, 15 days begins in 1449. What happened? Well, by adding the 391 years and 15 days to July 27, 1449, we arrive at August 11, 1840. And we studied in our last lesson how this was a very specific fulfillment. And it was a man named Josiah Litch who in 1838 began to read this prophecy and study this prophecy. He was a good, strong student of history and the Bible. And as he looked at world events and what was going on in the Middle East at this time and the turmoil that was taking place in the Middle East, he saw this prophecy and he said, this prophecy will be fulfilled in August 1840. Well, then he refined it and said, this prophecy will be fulfilled August 11th, 1840. And it was exactly. Because August 11th, 1840 was when the Ottoman Empire surrendered their power to the four great powers of Europe. He cried to Europe for protection because he had become so weak at that point that he was about to be overrun by the Sultanate of Egypt. He went to Europe for protection. England, Prussia, Austria, and Russia bound together to protect him. And that document was given into the hands of the Sultanate of Egypt August 11, 1840. These two prophecies, the 5 months prophecy and this prophecy of an hour, a day, a year, is absolutely fulfilled and tells us without a doubt that God is who he says he is. We cannot throw these prophecies into the future and say that they have a second application or that they have a first application in the future. They do not. This particular prophecy in Revelation had a profound impact on the religious world in the 19th century because it opened up the chronology of the Bible. It allowed Bible students all around the world, when they saw history fulfilled to the day as Josiah Litch predicted it would be, thousands of people were converted who had never been Christians before. They were converted when they saw that what Litch had discovered from reading Scripture and putting history together was true. It told them that the Bible was real. It told these apostates, it told these agnostics that God was real. by establishing the day for year chronology of the Bible, they were able then to go and crack the code in Daniel 8:14, and they knew that the 2300 days would come to an end in 1844. So we put all this together. Trumpets announce the coming of the Day of Atonement, declare the Day of Jubilee and Freedom, call, they are a call to remember the commandments of God. They declare war against the enemies. They declare the day of final judgment of the world. They proclaim the new king's coronation. And as we go through our study on proceeding on in Revelation, we will see that all of these things are fulfilled under the antitypical trumpets. They do announce the coming day of atonement, don't they? The blowing of that trumpet in 1844 was the announcement of the cosmic Day of Atonement. The final trumpet that is blown will declare the Day of Jubilee and Freedom. They declare war. The fifth trumpet and the sixth trumpet declared war against God's enemies, the apostate church. They also, that seventh trumpet, when it's blown, will proclaim the new king's coronation. Because when he comes, after that seventh trumpet, he will be King of Kings and Lord of Lords. The trumpets symbolize judgment is coming. The primary use of trumpets in the Old Testament was to warn of coming judgment against apostasy on the antitypical Day of Atonement. This is a summary chart of the trumpets. You have this as a handout. And from here on out, we're going to be studying the rest of the prophecies that talk of the deliverance for the righteous and the day of destruction for the wicked.